This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Good to be with you.
As we have been reporting all week on thetrumpet.com, we're witnessing a very important moment for NATO right now. The Transatlantic Alliance is under attack from some very important nations within that alliance. We talked on Wednesday's show about how as Russia threatens Ukraine, Germany is siding with Russia rather than its NATO allies, particularly the United States. While other European nations are actually following Germany's lead on this, for this story, we will go to Richard.
Yes, it's a story, I think, both about America being betrayed and countries turning against the United States. It's also a story about Germany's leadership. I think it is kind of remarkable the way that Germany really stood out as being on Russia's side and kind of being unique in the NATO alliance for turning their back on the United States and Ukraine and siding with Russia. But it didn't stand alone, or if it did, it didn't stand alone for very long. It's really interesting then to see how quickly some of these top nations in Western Europe swung right behind what Germany's doing. It's an interesting, you know, if you look at who's most vocal, say, on the European scene, then someone like Emmanuel Macron does kind of, I don't know, present himself like the leading leader of Europe or the most forceful politician in Europe. But you look at something like this, and Germany's got a new chancellor that has only just come in. I don't think he personally is necessarily particularly respected or anything like that.
Right.
But just the heft and clout that just comes from Germany itself, they take the lead on this. So we've seen in the kind of the latter half of this week, France and Italy swing behind Germany's lead. So France's Emmanuel Macron, he holds the rotating presidency of the European Union right now. And he has basically called for a new strategic partnership between the EU and Russia that's kind of separate from the United States. And he's been pushing for more negotiations in the Normandy format. The Normandy format is a negotiation, a way of negotiating about Ukraine that has Russia, Ukraine, France and Germany sitting around at a table. So you know, it excludes the United States. So he is absolutely following in this move. We have an article up on our website at the moment, France Follows Germany, Betrays Ukraine and NATO, from Joshua Michels. There's another interesting point that he brought out. You know, we were talking on Wednesday's show about how the German chancellor didn't have time to meet with Mr. Biden. And how remarkable that is. You know, you get an invitation to meet with supposedly the leader of the free world and you say, nah, too busy. Well, he did have time to meet with Emmanuel Macron, the German Chancellor Scholz and Mr. Macron. They got together on January 25th and talked about the importance of Franco-German friendship, talked about their common plans for dealing with the conflict in Ukraine. France swinging in behind Germany in a remarkable way.
So what has Italy done to throw its weight behind Germany?
So we're seeing a similar dynamic within Italy as we have seen within Germany, where Italian business leaders have really taken the lead. It was, again, kind of quite a dramatic push for unity with Russia, where Italian business leaders held talks with Vladimir Putin on January 26th. So, you know, getting together with Mr. Putin at this time where America is talking and really trying to drum up this case for sanctions against Russia, and you decide to go and sit down with Vladimir Putin, that's not some kind of innocently pre-planned meeting. That is you very deliberately sending a message. And it is really quite remarkable to see these Italian business leaders holding talks with Russia at this time. They were talking about the need to for further deepening cooperation. So, you know, this is something where the Italian government, you know, they kind of protested a bit or made some negative sounding noises, but it went ahead. And just as you had in Germany, business leaders kind of really pushing this Russian-German relationship, it seems like you've got kind of a similar dynamic in Italy, where you've got them pushing forwards. And Italy's economy really is locked in with Russia. You know, it's just kind of like with Germany. They made their choice a while ago. They got in bed with Russia. They knew where they were going with this. And now they're in this position where they're kind of locked into the Russian camp to a certain extent. So it's not too surprising to see Italy swinging behind Germany's lead as well.
Your article earlier in the week said, I think the title was Ukraine, what's happening in Ukraine shows Germany betraying the United States. You're viewing basically what France in particular is doing and also Italy as also a betrayal of the United States. Can you explain why that is the case?
Yeah, this is a continuation with something that we've seen in France for quite some time. You know, I think the French President Emmanuel Macron was very famous for calling NATO brain dead. He has been very vocal in kind of viewing this alliance as outdated. And so when we look at Germany working to undermine this alliance with NATO, or really you look at, like we talked about on Wednesday, Vladimir Putin, so much of what he's doing here isn't just about Ukraine. It's about deliberately trying to undermine NATO and split Europe off from the United States. And you see Germany helping him with that. And you see France and you see Italy helping him with that. You see these countries, instead of saying, well, let's come together as an alliance in this difficult time, saying, well, let's sit down with Putin, let's meet with Mr. Putin, let's see if we can, we want a different approach. We're going to try and work against having sanctions. We're going to work against the United States being able to promise any kind of economic backlash, economic punishment for Mr. Putin. So we're really seeing these guys pulling in a different direction to NATO and to the United States. I think what really stands out about France is this is something that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has really drawn attention to. He had a couple of different articles in the Trumpet print, almost a mini series of them. France is betraying America and fulfilling Bible prophecy, and France rejects America and empowers Germany. And those were all about France choosing Germany over America. And you look at what is happening in this situation, and that is exactly what you see. There are two conflicting approaches on how to deal with this, and France is choosing Germany and Russia, not the United States. And in those articles, Mr. Fleury really brings in that biblical background. You know, at the heart and core of everything that we say about what's going on in Europe, what's going on in the world, is this prophecy about modern Israel, about the United States and Britain being a descendant, being descendants from the ancient nations of Israel. And France, or at least a good chunk of France, is also a descendant of one of those tribes of Israel. They're descended from the tribe of Reuben. And so to see France turning against Britain and America is really a kind of a more personal type of betrayal, or a deeper kind of betrayal than, say, Germany or Italy, where it's an Israelite country betraying their Israelite brothers, siding with Germany. And so Mr. Fleury talked about how this is prophesied. He went back through Genesis 37, talked about Reuben betraying his younger brother Joseph, and he says, your Bible says Reuben's modern descendants will again betray the latter-day descendants of Joseph, America and Britain. And that was back in 2018 that he was writing that. And we see another example of that happening in what's going on with Europe just in the last week.
Well, very good. We will link to this article that Josue Michels wrote, France Follows Germany, Betrays Ukraine and NATO. We also have this article that is scheduled to come up very soon on thetrumpet.com, Italy's industry promises Putin their support. That Michels article links to those articles from Gerald Fleury, those that explain this this drama playing out between these fellow Israelite nations, as Richard mentioned there, a really important prophecy to get in mind as you watch this unfolding, this relationship that is fraying between the United States and these European nations. We thank you very much for bringing that to us, Richard. Vladimir Putin has been pretty busy ramping up his military for possible invasion of Ukraine, but at the same time, he's managing to push Russia's interests in Latin America. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, the situation in Ukraine is continuing to grow, you know, just more and more combustible. There may well be more than 150,000 troops that Vladimir Putin has there now. So there are just serious fears that he's about to commit a monumental crime with a military invasion. And we've seen some reactions. You know, the U.S. now has 8,500 troops on heightened alert for possible deployment to eastern Ukraine. The U.S. and a few other nations also have started withdrawing some of their embassy staffers or their family members from Ukraine. So the threat is being taken very seriously. And there was a major development on Wednesday regarding that big list of, you know, just ludicrous demands that Putin made for the U.S. and NATO. That was the list that he issued about a month ago, basically demanding that Ukraine can never be allowed to join NATO. NATO drills can't take place in certain areas without Russian approval, and that no new NATO forces can be deployed. It was just a stunning list that would have really gutted NATO. But on Wednesday, the Biden administration hand-delivered a letter to Putin's government, and it did reject all of Russia's demands. It reiterated that NATO has an open-door policy, said NATO would not be pulling any troops back. So this was not really unexpected, since giving in to Putin's demands would have been just a stunning act of overt surrender. But it still has increased the volatility of the whole situation. And as you mentioned, at the same time that all this has been playing out, Putin has been working hard to strengthen Russia's ties with Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. So he's trying to, I think in some ways, trying to show the U.S. how it feels to have your adversary deepening alliances right in your backyard or your sphere of influence. Russia has actually been working for many years to deepen ties with these Latin American nations. But now those efforts seem to be in a higher gear. So there was a big phone call this week that Putin made to the president of Cuba. They talked about deepening all levels of cooperation between Russia and Cuba and even building a strategic partnership. A couple of days before that, Putin spoke with the presidents of Venezuela and Nicaragua for the same purpose, really, just to shore up their ties and to lay out plans for Russia to deepen its ties with both of them as well. So all this comes just a couple of weeks after Russia's deputy foreign minister had suggested that Russia might actually be deploying soldiers to Cuba and Venezuela just to put more pressure on the U.S. So these are nations that are, of course, geographically very near to the U.S., and it seems to be just one more sign of how potentially explosive this whole situation has become.
Yeah, putting those two situations together, that this is happening simultaneously, that Vladimir Putin is definitely trying to send a message to the United States. It's at least a little bit reassuring that the United States didn't cave into those demands from Vladimir Putin, but he doesn't seem deterred and seems like he's determined to push every advantage that he can against the United States right now.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And these countries that he's working with there, he knows very well that when Americans hear about Russia forging deeper alliances with Cuba, with Venezuela, with Nicaragua, that's very unsettling, because those are located right along the Caribbean Sea that America ships a great deal of its imports and exports through. The port of New Orleans, the port of Houston are both just central to the U.S. economy. So having U.S. adversaries in a position where they could block those ports is just deeply worrying. And of course, that's why Putin is working now to boost his cooperation with these nations. Since the U.S. and NATO have rejected his demands, he's not just building up near Ukraine, but he's also getting better positioned even against the U.S. itself.
We actually spoke, I think it was last week, about China making greater incursions into Latin America. Russia and China seem to be pretty coordinated in their efforts. There's a lot of talk about just how what Russia is doing in Ukraine correlates with China's activities in Taiwan. We'll talk about that in the second half. But this idea of these Asian giants actually moving right into America's backyard, into these Caribbean nations and Latin America, really is concerning to the United States for a lot of reasons. And prophecy underscores why even more.
That's right. Yes. Prophecies in Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 talk about an economic alliance that will very soon take shape. And the scriptures show that the main parties in this alliance will be Russia and China and several European countries, several of those that Richard just spoke about, actually. And then there's a related passage in Deuteronomy 28 that shows that this economic alliance will actually besiege America and block it out of world trade. So we have an article up on thetrumpet.com right now. It's called Putin Threatens the Caribbean by our own Andrew Miller here. And it examines these passages and it shows that when this economic alliance materializes, it's going to just devastate the U.S. economy. This article looks at those Caribbean nations that Putin is now working with, you know, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and it shows how this besiegement of America will happen in large part from those areas. One section of it says, half of America's seaborne trade passes through the Gulf of Mexico. Therefore, a hostile foreign power controlling the Caribbean Sea could cripple the U.S. economy by restricting its access to oceanic shipping. So, you know, if any listener would like to better see why it's so alarming to see right now Putin working to deepen his ties with those Caribbean countries, I would encourage them to take a look at that article, Putin Threatens the Caribbean.
All right, we'll link to that in the show notes. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. As negotiations continue over Iran's nuclear activities, Iran continues to push its ballistic missile program to increase its range to include Europe. To learn about this, we'll go to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, there was a series of interviews that were done in the middle of January on inside Iranian media, and they're only starting to get reported right now, which talks about these tests that took place at the end of December of new ballistic missile technology of the Iranians, which uses, instead of liquid fuels, solid fuels, which allows them to allows the fuel itself to be much lighter inside these ballistic missiles, and therefore the missile can go further. Iranian newspaper quoted Brigadier General Amir Ali Hajizadeh, and he heads the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Aerospace Division. And so basically he is in charge of the ballistic missile technology and that program. And it talked about how that they tested this Rafale engine, which is so powerful that it has the ability to increase the range on Iran's ballistic missiles from about 2,000 kilometers, what they are right now, all the way through to 5,000 kilometers. And this is a substantial increase. Of course, the Iranians have said that they do not want to increase their ballistic missile reach past 2,000 kilometers. And they have looked to stick to that for the past couple of, let's say, from about 2015 onwards. And yet with these series of tests, it seems that they have changed that policy and they are going for the full 5,000 kilometers. And so that's, if you're in northwestern Iran and you're firing this, that will reach everywhere in Europe. That'll reach Portugal. That'll even reach to Iceland. That's so all of Europe then would then become under the ballistic missile umbrella of the Iranians, within reach of an Iranian missile.
How much does this undermine the rhetoric that comes from Iran as nuclear negotiations are going on, and you have, it seems, some Iranian officials that seem like they want to reassure the world that they pose no threat. European leaders are looking at a development like this and saying, we know better.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously something that's incredibly worrying for the Europeans. I mean, Iran told Europe back in 2017 that if you want to bring the ballistic missiles into the Iran nuclear deal, then we're just going to increase our ballistic missile range to include all of Europe instead of just some Eastern European states. And so they've got to be worried about this. Of course, Iran couches its or hides its ambition or says that this technology, these solid state fuels, are not going to be used for a ballistic missile. Instead, it's all about rockets going into space.
However, that's wonderful to know that if you're a European, that's what the Iranians are saying. However, it really does increase your vulnerability when you know that Iran is weeks away from nuclear breakout. These stories like that keep on coming out, how close they are to a nuclear weapon. And everyone says, well, they don't have the delivery system, don't have the delivery system. Maybe they didn't to deliver it all the way into Europe. But that's what they're working on right now, making sure everywhere in Europe can be hit. It's making sure Germany can be hit. It's making sure the UK can be hit. This is what Iranian does. It's a pushy foreign policy, pushy foreign power. And that's what the Bible talks about them being.
Yeah, describe that prophecy for our listeners.
Yeah, this is found in Daniel 11, verse 40. It talks about how in the time of the end, or these latter days, the king of the south, which Mr. Flurry has talked about being radical Islam led by Iran, it pushes at the king of the north, which is a German-led Europe. And it because of this pushing, it causes a massive, overwhelming response, a blitzkrieg response from Europe. Why do they act so fast? Perhaps it's because they are extremely threatened by what Iran can do, not just by what Iran is saying it can do, but they recognize that they are actually vulnerable to the to the Iranians. That could be both through shipping. We've talked about the Iran's control of the important shipping ways. It can also be because Iran now would then have access to nuclear weapons and could hit the European mainland in any way. And so as you see Iran push towards having this ability, Europe needs to prepare for its response. And the Bible says it will be doing that.
If people want more information about that prophecy, where would you send them, Brent?
Our trend article is really, really good. It's called Iran and Europe Heading for a Clash of Civilizations, and it details the prophecy about these two powers.
Well, thank you, Brent. We will link to that article in our show notes. The Biden administration in America is building up quite a record on policy regarding pipelines. It's shutting down American pipelines, greenlighting the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. They just shut down another pipeline that also hurts the interests of America and its traditional allies while helping our enemies. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, the Biden administration definitely does have what is a seemingly complicated relationship with pipelines. I mean, one of the first things Joe Biden did in his very first afternoon in office was cancel the Keystone pipeline from Canada to the United States. But then only 6 months later, his administration was involved in negotiations with Germany to make sure that the Nord Stream pipeline from Russia to Germany got greenlit. Now, just this week, there's coming out some new revelations about just how active the Biden administration was in canceling the Eastern Mediterranean gas pipeline that would have brought 10 billion cubic meters of natural gas from Israel to the European Union by pumping it underneath the Mediterranean Sea and into Greece. Now, according to the documents that are coming out, the Biden administration told Israel back in November that it was going to pull support from this pipeline. President Trump had previously strongly supported it. And the reason they cited at the time was kind of vague. They said it would just undermine Middle Eastern security. Just last week, they've given papers to Greece, which is the nation the pipeline was supposed to run into, giving a little more detail, saying that it would undermine Middle Eastern security and that the United States is really looking more at renewable energy than pipeline energy. So the same excuse they used to shut down the Keystone pipeline. So when it comes to natural gas pipelines from Canada to the United States or from Israel to Greece, climate change and renewable energy are apparently really big concerns. When it comes to natural gas pipelines from Russia to Germany, that never even made the agenda in any of those meetings. Mm-hmm. And so you can really see here that the climate change thing is really an excuse, especially with this East Med pipeline. One of the real reasons they did it is the president of Turkey was very against it, even deploying some Turkish military ships to the area around Cyprus last year is kind of a shot across the bow. And so the Biden administration is really trying to appease him. And you can definitely tell that as soon as the papers broke in Greece, that the Biden administration had pulled support for this EastMed pipeline. President Erdogan of Turkey was basically crowing, and he was telling the Turkish media that he said, if Israel wants to send any gas to Europe, it won't get there unless it flows through a pipeline passing through Turkey. So Turkey wants to set itself up as kind of like the conduit nation for all Middle Eastern gas into the European Union, similar how now Germany is trying to set itself up as the new conduit nation for all Russian gas going into the European Union. So between the two of them, Germany and Turkey, pretty much all gas that isn't pumped from a native oil field in Norway or the Netherlands, all gas coming from outside the European continent. Is going to have to flow through one of these two nations. And the fact that the Biden administration has been so selective in canceling pipelines from Canada, canceling pipelines from Israel, but supporting any pipeline projects from Russia or from Turkey shows that the renewable energy concerns isn't really what's at stake here. The Biden administration is very pro natural gas pipelines from Germany or Turkey. He's just trying to undermine pipelines from Canada and Israel, which is hugely prophetically significant. When you look at the bond with Canada as an Ephraimite nation, America, a Manassite nation, and Israel from the tribe of Judah, that he's trying to undermine basically anything that would bolster the energy independence or the energy dominance in some cases of Israelite nations by making Europe completely reliant on these Gentile powers like Turkey, Germany, and Russia, and not just any Gentile powers, but some of the most tyrannical powers. I mean, Turkey and Russia are a couple of the strongest dictatorships on the world today. And Germany isn't regarded as a dictatorship, but it definitely has a history of being just as bad as Turkey and Russia when the cards are down.
It's amazing to look at these in light of the Trump administration's pipeline policies. They were pro all of the oil coming in from Canada, all of those pipelines. They wanted those open. They wanted to Nord Stream shut down this Middle Eastern pipeline. They were all for it. And that policy, he did a remarkable job of making America energy independent and preventing this energy being used as a weapon by some of these by Russia, by Iran. Biden is turning that around in a hurry. And as you said, there seems to be a design behind this. It points to really what Gerald Fleury has been saying about this administration being an extension of an Antiochus administration.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, President Trump, between his domestic oil policies and his pro-Canada oil policies, he was pretty much going to make North America energy independent. We might have still had to import a little bit from Mexico, but other than that, like Mexico, the U.S. and Canada could have supplied all their own energy needs by trading with each other, and you wouldn't have even had to rely on the rest of the world. Similar, Israel, I think, pretty much already does supply its own energy needs, but this EastMed pipeline would have 10 billion cubic meters. That's only about a fifth of what Nord Stream is, but it would definitely have been able to make a good chunk of Europe reliant on Israeli gas instead of being overly reliant on Russian gas. But the Biden administration has completely flipped this like a photo negative,
yeah,
where he supports the pipelines Trump opposed, and he opposes the pipelines Trump support.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, it is just really bolstering these Gentile powers that are trying to undermine America on the world scene. And he uses climate change as an excuse, but like I said, climate change would apply to all pipelines equally.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't explain the discrepancy of why he supports Russian and Turkish pipelines, but not Canadian or Israeli ones. And the only explanation is like I said, what our editor-in-chief wrote in his article, this isn't incompetence, this is treason. No, that article wasn't about pipelines. It was about the withdrawal from Afghanistan. But the idea that this withdrawal of Afghanistan, it wasn't just that the Joint Chiefs of Staff are a bunch of idiots, but that they're deliberately trying to undermine the United States. And you definitely see that same spirit with this pipeline story, that they know what they're doing, and it's they know they're trying to undermine America on the world scene, using climate change as an excuse for people don't look into it too much. But it doesn't take very much investigation to see that this is really an agenda that supports any pipeline that undercuts American energy independence and opposes any pipeline that bolsters that energy independence.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will link to that article. This isn't incompetence. This is treason. And also Gerald Flory's booklet, America Under Attack, to understand the spiritual dimension to what we see coming out of the White House today. Thank you for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll look at China's threatening activity toward Taiwan and an important look at why Russia and China support Iran. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
As we mentioned in the first half, as Russia threatens Ukraine, China is making some troubling maneuvers against Taiwan. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was on Sunday that China's Air Force flew 39 warplanes into Taiwan's air defense identification zone. These Chinese warplanes included 34 fighter jets, a couple of electronic warfare planes, a couple of intelligence gathering planes, and then one H-6 nuclear bomber. So just a, you know, just a brazen display of belligerence by China against Taiwan. And this came in response to the U.S. conducting some military exercises in that area with Japan. Those exercises were some large and some well-coordinated ones. They involved two American aircraft carriers along with their, you know, accompanying vessels and several of Japan's vessels as well. And so with these incursions into Taiwan's air defense zone, China was just demonstrating its anger toward the U.S. and Japan. China, of course, has never accepted Taiwan as an independent country. The Chinese Communist Party has vowed on several occasions to bring Taiwan under its power, even saying that it's fully prepared to use military force to do that if necessary. And over the last couple of months, it sort of seemed like China had grown a little bit quieter toward Taiwan, but this display, these incursions this week, show that nothing has changed with China's belligerence, and this is a conflict that could explode really at any time.
The people of Taiwan have to be watching what's happening with Russia and Ukraine, the way that these European nations are turning against the United States, and how the United States is just kind of withdrawing from the scene with real concern, because Taiwan has relied so heavily on security guarantees from the United States, and it seems like those really are very thin protection against what China is threatening to do.
Yeah, I think they look at what's happening with Ukraine right now, and they're probably deeply unsettled by that. I think they look back to the Afghanistan withdrawal,
right,
and that gives them a lot of cause for alarm as well. It's a worrying time right now to be dependent on the United States for your security.
What kind of position would the United States be in with this kind of coordinated strategy that we're seeing from Russia and China? If Russia invades Ukraine, China, it seems, would almost have a free pass.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of the current global dynamic that makes these various developments just even more worrying, because, you know, at the same time that China's ramping up pressure on Taiwan, everything we spoke about in the first half is also underway with you know, Putin amassing huge numbers of troops near Ukraine. And these two, of course, Russia and China, they're partners in crime. They have each other's backs. They would love nothing more than to see the U.S. deposed from its position as global hegemon. So more and more analysts are worrying about whether Russia and China might actually synchronize their invasions. You know, Russia in Ukraine, China in Taiwan. And that would seriously complicate any kind of military response by the U.S. The U.S. still does have the world's most powerful military, but there was an analysis published recently by the Heritage Foundation showing that if two significant conflicts erupted at the same time, the U.S. military could be stretched very thin and could really struggle to muster any kind of adequate response. So to know about those limitations for the U.S. military, and then to see Russia and China both beating the war drums at the same time right now, I think that shows just really how delicate the global peace is right now.
Where would you send people to understand just the prophetic implications of what we're seeing here between China and Taiwan?
We have an article up on thetrumpet.com right now about this. It's called Taiwan is China's Ukraine by Mihailo Zekic. And then we also have a free booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy. And there's a whole section in there all about Taiwan. And it's built on what Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has said on this topic. So I think both of those pieces of literature would be excellent places to start.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. We spoke in the first half about how powerful Germany's leadership has become within Europe. This is evident in this drama that's playing out regarding NATO. There's more evidence of this emerging in Germany's economic activities in Eastern Europe. To look at this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is a remarkable glance at the kind of nuts and bolts of German power and really how a lot of Europe, it's not just Germany that kind of has to do what German businesses want, but a lot of Europe. So there's a French insurer that Coface, I don't know how they pronounce that in France, probably, I don't know, Coface or something. they put together an annual ranking of the top biggest 500 Eastern European businesses. And one of the things that's remarkable just about every year, but especially this year, is how many of these top Eastern European businesses are German. So, for example, the number two biggest Eastern European business is Skoda, which is, of course, owned by Volkswagen. And then Volkswagen itself, Volkswagen Slovakia was sixth on the list. Audi's Hungarian branch is eighth on the list. Lidl, I think, people at least over in the UK are pretty familiar with. I don't know if you have Lidl in the US, but Lidl's Polish branch is number 10. German energy company, number 13. Bosch, Bosch's Hungarian subsidiary, number 17. So they keep cropping up all across these top lists. And then when you look at each country individually, this pattern comes across even more clearly. So, for example, Skoda is the Czech Republic's largest corporation. Volkswagen Slovakia is Slovakia's largest company. Audi, Hungary's second largest company, with MVM being their third and Bosch the fourth largest. And only Poland and Lithuania are the only two countries where their largest companies are homegrown. So, I mean, imagine you're going into as a country some of these different decisions that are going on. Okay, well, what do we do with Russia? This kind of thing. Some of these German businesses are your number one employer. So if they go under, if they pull out, if they have a bit of a setback, that directly affects your unemployment levels. It directly affects your prosperity. It directly affects your popularity as a leader. And really, there's been a lot that has, you know, everybody along the Danube River has kind of been integrated into one supply chain. There's a lot of, say, independent Eastern European businesses, and their whole business model revolves around making the raw materials for other German companies. You know, they're part of, say, the Skoda Volkswagen supply chain, even if they're not necessarily owned by Volkswagen. So this reach of German businesses goes even further than just these companies that are German subsidiaries. You've got all of these companies that just make their business solely from selling parts to these bigger German companies. So it means that there's just an incredible clout that Germany has in Eastern Europe, and you don't see it very much. It's not a power that's used particularly much. And then you have things like the Greek crisis that happened, you know, about 10 years ago now, and suddenly that reveals German power. You get a glimpse of it in what's going on in Ukraine. So it's easy to ignore because it only tends to manifest itself in some of those bigger, more dramatic moments. But Germany really does have a lot of very practical power across all of Eastern Europe.
Bible prophecy talks about the unification of Europe. This is one of the pillar prophecies, end time prophecies that we're expecting to see. I just think it's fascinating, this particular story, in light of this cover story that Gerald Fleury just wrote in the new Trumpet print edition, talking about the rise of German industry and the role that German business is playing in the trend toward unification within Europe. These countries, like you're talking about, these Eastern European nations, they have reason to fear Germany. They have reason to distrust Germany, and yet they're being pulled inexorably into this relationship because of these business interests. It's quite fascinating to watch, and really, I think people would do well to read that cover story of Gerald Fleury in the New Trumpet to see the historical and prophetic implications of what we're seeing here. We also have this article by Mihailo Zekic on the website, the title of that, Germany's Economic Takeover of Eastern Europe, that we'll link to in the show notes. Quite a fascinating trend to see developing. Thank you for that, Richard. The Biden administration works together with Russia and China regarding Iran, as if those nations share core interests regarding the Iranians. But there's a major flaw in that approach, because they don't share America's interests regarding Iran. To learn about this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
There's an important piece in the Wall Street Journal written by Byron Clark and Michael Doron, both of them senior fellows at the Hudson Institute in the United States. And it's entitled Why Russia and China Build Up Iran. And it's really quite interesting. It's similar to what we spoke about last week. And that was, at that time, we were talking about why Russia, well, the fact that Russia and China were engaged in war games with Iran in the Northern Indian Ocean, and spoke a little bit about why they might be buddy-buddy together, especially at this time. And this article, I think, does a better job than I did at kind of showing why Russia and China have specific interests in building up the Iranians right now. And in terms of, or at least according to them, they say this is the second sentence from their piece. Washington engages with Beijing and Moscow as if they share core United States interests with respect to Iran, when instead they are working with Tehran to undermine the American-led global order. And he gives a couple of reasons to why, or a couple of instances to show that it's kind of crazy that you have the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, negotiating with the Russians over the Iranian nuclear program, the Russians touting that they're going to have some type of temporary nuclear deal with the Iranians to try and limit it, and the United States is all supportive of that, of course, not realizing, or at least giving into the fable that Russia is trying to do anything but weaken the United States through allowing such an interim nuclear deal with the Iranians. So in terms of what Russia can get out of the Iranian relationship, it talks about how it's really important for Russia to ensure that the United States, or ensure that Russia has access to the Mediterranean Sea and increases its footprint in the Mediterranean. Of course, we know about this because of its actions inside Syria and how it operates a naval base on the Mediterranean coast there. And these two authors link it to what's going on with Ukraine right now, to ensure that Putin would have access without a strong, independent Ukrainian nation in the way, or at least a stumbling block for their ambition in the Mediterranean, in the Middle East, and elsewhere. That's, of course, why they took Crimea to get that warm water port. And it's, of course, why they support the Assad regime right now, so that Russia has access to the Mediterranean again. And, of course, Assad is in a relationship with Iran. And so this is all about Russia trying to increase its power position in the Middle East, is why it's supporting the Iranians, and again, at the expense of the U.S. And then when it came to China, I thought this was interesting. This is what the authors state, which brings us back to Iran. This is further on. In the event of a war in China, war in Taiwan, China will look to Tehran and its proxies to mount threats to shipping to pin down one or more American carrier groups in the Persian Gulf. So it's talking about this grand strategy for a Taiwanese takeover by the Chinese, and how if the United States will not be allowed or able to bring all its weaponry to a defense of China, because the Iranians could strike up a dangerous situation in the Middle East at the same time. It also talks about how the Chinese economy is really dependent on Middle East oil, and how a relationship with Iran not only makes sure that they have oil, access to oil, but that the Iranians might run out the United States from the Middle East with all these provocative actions that they're making right now, so the United States could not cut off that oil also. And so they say this in the very conclusion: in sum, China and Russia are building up Iran. Both need a partner in the Middle East devoted to resistance to undermining U.S. Power. Why is the Biden team going along for the ride? And so it just seems like with all these friendly negotiations, or at least talks over Iran with China and Russia, they're missing the boat here. All parties are in it to undermine the United States' strength.
This kind of strategic naivety on the part of American leaders is truly troubling and very dangerous. All of these interests that you're describing for Russia and China really are quite evident, but it does seem like there's almost a willful ignorance on the part of these American leaders that there is absolutely no way that Iran is going to be able to be isolated when you have these massive Asian countries that are so willing to lend its support in its activities, and there's nothing deterring them, regardless of what Iran does, it seems, no matter how nefarious, how dangerous their activities are. These nations in Asia seem perfectly willing to go along with what Iran does.
Yeah, well, they're not threatened then by Iran's power at the moment. And if they all have a strategic strategic alignment to weaken the United States, I mean, it makes sense for them to go along with it. But you do get to the point where whether you ask the question whether this is just blundering by right. the Biden administration, or whether this is something that is directly attributed to a really a more evil and sinister motive that would seek to make the United States a very vulnerable place, that purposefully wants the United States to seem weak. Of course, we have so much power the United States has right now, but the appeasement of Iran, of Russia, and China makes the United States incredibly vulnerable going forward towards its destruction. Melanie Phillips has a piece, How the West Appeasement Mentality Brings Not Peace But War. And she says this is from today: America's incompetent blunderings around the world have been closely watched by Russia, China, and Iran. They are calculating that they can get away with invading Ukraine or Taiwan or building nuclear weapons because the United States hasn't got what it takes to stop them. And that's right. I mean, Putin understands that the only way that he's going to have to stop is if the United States puts forth some effort to stop them. And everybody, it seems, around the world, these three powers in particular, are willing to push the United States to see and find out. And as we know from what Mr. Flurry has been giving us for the past decade about the Obama-led government, and Biden's just continuing that foreign policy right now, the United States is it might make it seem like it's playing along in negotiations to try and counter these actions, but this is a government that is actually intent on pushing America over the edge towards its destruction. And I think people around the world, they should be worried when you see just an emboldened Russia, China, Iran that attempting the United States to act against them. And if there's no threat of force, if there's no threat of retaliation for the United States to stand up for its morals or its principles, then what happens to the rest of the world? This is not just about the United States' downfall, but the United States' world order. The policeman of the world is no longer there, and this is a dangerous place for the world to be in.
It makes me think of the chapter in Great Again that talks specifically about the Obama-led Iran policy and how it really was, as you said, a deliberate effort to undermine the United States standing in the world, in the Middle East in particular. It's a extremely dangerous policy that the Biden administration has taken up again, and Iran is certainly taking advantage of that. We can link to that in the show notes. Anything else that you might direct people to for more prophetic context?
Well, for the larger point about, I think, these three nations coming together in the face of Western appeasement, I think the Winston Churchill, The Watchman booklet by Mr. Gerald Flurry would be great, kind of going back and looking at history to see what we're going through again, yet without that Watchman.
All right. Thanks for that, Brent. One final story today. Canadians are protesting vaccine mandates in massive numbers. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it takes a lot to upset a Canadian. They're a fairly polite lot, but Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has managed to do just that. As we speak, there is currently an 11,000 semi-strong convoy stretching out for 93 miles, moving across the Canadian nation. It started in British Columbia and is working its way all the way to Ottawa, Ontario, where it plans to hold a protest against vaccine mandates at the end of this month. Now, the Trudeau administration is pretty upset about this. I've heard there are even a lot of like local Canadian media outlets are comparing this to Canada's January 6th protest.
Of course.
And Trudeau said that he's really upset at conservative fear-mongering, but the reason this convoy is protesting is over vaccine mandates. Earlier this month, the United States passed a bill saying that unvaccinated semi-truckers cannot cross the Canadian border, and the Canadian government followed suit a week later saying unvaccinated Canadian truckers cannot pass the U.S. border. So unvaccinated truckers from either nation can't actually go into the neighboring nation. And you just look at the statistics of that, about 16% of truckers are unvaccinated. That's about 26,000 people. And so now just stopping and thinking for a little bit, it's like, well, what's that mean that 16% of the semi-truckers can't cross the border? I mean, that's going to exacerbate the supply chain shortages. Both America and Canada are suffering tremendously. America's actually pretty reliant on Canadian auto parts. They've already had some pretty bad auto part stories. I think I talked a few months ago about my experience waiting 8 weeks for a transmission part to get my car back on, back working. And so this has been a problem for me and a lot of other people since like mid last year. And like, how much worse is this going to get when, like I said, you might even have the auto part make its way over from China, be reassembled in a Canadian factory, and then stuck on a semi-truck at the Canadian border that can't cross simply because the driver of the truck is unvaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that really exacerbates those problems quite a bit in a way that's going to make supply chain shortages and cost. When supply goes, supply and demand, when supply goes down, cost goes up. Joe Biden keeps telling us that the solution to inflation is his Build Back Better program, because even though it does pump $2 trillion that he made out of thin air into the money supply, it's going to make our infrastructure better so the supply chain problems won't be as bad. But he's not telling the truth, because the problem isn't that we don't have roads and that we don't have trucks. The problem is the truckers can't cross the border because of these vaccine mandates. And so hopefully this protest in Canada will convince some policymakers on both sides of the border to reconsider their position on that. But we brought out last year in an article I wrote entitled Rising Prices, Empty Shelves, that these supply chain shortages, they're really kind of a preview of the like I said, the famine and the pestilence that you'll see in these Ezekiel 5 prophesied destruction. There's talks about a great trade siege there in Ezekiel 4 and Ezekiel 5. And these COVID-induced supply chain shortages are not that trade siege, but it definitely is a shot across the bow, just kind of alerting the people of American Canada to how fragile our supply lines are and how little it takes to just prompt runaway inflation and empty shelves when those lines that we get our goods from nations all around the world experience a bottleneck like they're experiencing right now at the Canadian border.
It's quite something to watch this developing, and as you said, so much of it is self-inflicted. Leaders who are prioritizing their own political agendas over the well-being of the people and the standard of living is going to suffer. And we've been talking about this for a long time, and even Herbert W. Armstrong before us. We'll link to that article that you wrote, Rising Prices, Empty Shelves, to get an idea of the prophetic implications of those supply chain problems. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Neil deGrasse Tyson. Objective truths are established by evidence, personal truths by faith, political truths by incessant repetition. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.